The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. At 10 o'clock on the evening of the 6th of May in 2010, the BBC's election coverage crossed live to their exit poll.
10 o'clock. And this is what we're saying. It's going to be a hung parliament with the Conservatives as the largest party. And the figures? The Conservatives on 307, short by 19 of the 326 they'd need for an overall majority.
It proved to be astonishingly accurate, and by the next morning, and with very little sleep, Westminster woke to a new reality. The Conservatives had won the most seats, but no party had an overall majority. For the first time since 1974, Britain had a hung parliament, with constitutional experts working round the clock. Gordon Brown remained in Downing Street. The voters had spoken, but it'd be the politicians who would then have to decide who governed Britain. For 5 nights and 5 days, frantic negotiations and deals and counter-deals took place in the deserted rooms of Westminster, which are stuck in suspended animation. The rest, as they say, is history, and one of the first to write it is Andrew Adonis, Lord Adonis, who was one of Labour's chief negotiators in those remarkable 5 days, and he's here with me now. So, Andrew, let's begin on that night. As the exit poll figures were in, did you genuinely believe that there was a possible world in which Labour was going to cling on in some form in government?
I'd believed it was possible from the midway through the campaign, when it was clear that the Conservatives were finding it very difficult to get much above 35% of the vote. And given particularly how the seats were distributed, that was going to make it very hard for them to get an overall majority. And as I relate in the book, I'd been keen we make serious contingency plans for a hung parliament. And those contingency plans needed, obviously, to include the possibility that we would continue in government. I'd thought that it was most likely we'd continue in government if there was an overall Lab Lib majority. There wasn't in the event. We were, depending on how you do the calculations, because the Sinn Féin MPs don't take their seats, of course, but we were anywhere between 7 and 10 seats short of an overall majority, which meant that Labour plus the Lib Dems could themselves only form a minority government. But nonetheless, it was a minority government that could comfortably outvote the Conservatives. 315 plays 307. And as I describe in the book, the other minor parties were very likely to support a Lab Lib government, particularly for the first year before the Scottish and Welsh elections, since neither the Scottish nor the Welsh nationalists would have wanted to precipitate an early election, even if they hadn't been more anti-conservative than anti-Labour, which of course they were. And so I thought from the moment that the exit poll came out that there was a serious possibility of a Lab Lib government, and we played it accordingly over the following 5 days.
Now, Andrew, I mean, it's a terrific page turner, and you know, I understand it's people are reading it like a thriller, but isn't there an element of fiction in there, in this imagined possibility that Labour and the Lib Dems could have locked something together after the country thought, by giving Labour one of its worst performances ever, that it had kicked Labour out of office? Isn't that the missing...
Well, the country also gave the Conservatives one of their worst performances ever. So, I mean, in a sense, the whole reason why the Parliament was hung was that neither of the major parties had done well, and we had to try and make the best of it. I mean, remember, Cameron in 2010 polls only 36% of the vote, which is an incredibly low percentage of the vote, and he's 20 seats short of a majority. So it was perfectly legitimate for there to have been a Lab Lib government. And one of the key facts that we deployed all the way through those 5 days, particularly when discussing economic policy with the Lib Dems, because insofar as there'd been a big issue in the election, it was, of course, economic policy, and in particular, whether people wanted the Darling Plan or the Osborne Plan, that is, whether they wanted further and faster cuts than Labour was proposing. That was a big issue in the election. And on that issue, the country lined up 15 million for the Darling Plan, Labour plus the Lib Dems, against 10 million for the Osborne Plan, which was the Conservatives. And indeed, all of the minor parties that expressed views on economic policy were with the Darling Plan rather than the Osborne Plan. That was very clear as the outcome. So I didn't think there was anything at all illegitimate about us seeking to put a majority together between us. And of course, if you look at continental coalitions, though it's the most common combination is with the largest party. It's not uncommon for the second largest party to lead a coalition. Willy Brandt's great coalition in Germany, the SPD was the second largest party. The existing Swedish centre-right coalition is led by the second largest party, smaller than the Swedish SPD. So it depends very much on the issues and the personalities and the zeitgeist, what it is that people think that it is going to work in terms of the politics of the day. And I thought that was perfectly compatible with a Lib government in 2010.
On that zeitgeist point, though, I mean, there's people you talk about in the book who were Labour critics of the idea of a coalition. So we had John Reid and David Blunkett earlier on, and then later going public, Andy Burnham. Wouldn't they say, you know, it was all right for you, Andrew, you were in the House of Lords, you hadn't had to go and fight for your own seat in the same way, and that they'd been dealing with the voters and they'd got what the zeitgeist was, and whatever it was, there might not have been a winner, but there was a loser, and it was Gordon Brown's Labour Party. Do you not think, you know, it was so clear that Labour was on the way down that that's the thing that made it inevitable?
Well, the overwhelming majority of those who'd been elected at the top of the party were also in favour of seeking to negotiate a coalition with the Lib Dems if it could be done on a workable policy prospectus. In the crucial meeting of the Cabinet on the Monday to decide whether we were going to open negotiations formally with the Lib Dems after the exploratory talks that there'd been the day before, no one spoke up against. Even those who, in fact, were against were subdued, because the overwhelming majority of those who spoke, led by Gordon Brown, Harriet Harman, Alan Johnson, the two Milibands, Ed Balls, were strongly in favour of seeking to negotiate a coalition if we could get a policy prospectus that worked. And that was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, because as Ed Miliband said during that discussion, at the end of this process, there's going to be a Labour or Conservative Prime Minister, and we can't go back to our constituencies and tell them we let the Conservatives come in because we weren't even prepared to see if we could make it work with the Lib Dems. But of course, by then, it was essentially over, because it was by then clear that the Conservatives and the Lib Dems were reaching, very close as it happens, to reaching full agreement on their economic plan. And once you've got agreement on an economic plan, then of course the rest is detail, essentially.
You've made the case there in strong terms for Labour having a go. The way that the issue played out in the press was more about the fact that it was Gordon Brown who had to go, even if Labour didn't. You know, we had the squatter in number 10, age 59 or whatever it was, on the Sun. I wonder, when you look back on that, with Gordon Brown saying things about sticking the course for the first few months, you know, to get the new government in place and to secure the economic recovery, which I have to say sounded a very open-ended task, whether you think, first of all, whether there was something wrong with Gordon Brown that he didn't understand that he had to go, and secondly, whether there was something wrong in the culture of the top of a Labour Party that had given him an unchallenged coronation, that people weren't pointing out to him from the time that exit poll went through that if Labour was to have a chance of staying in place, he'd need to go.
The view that we took was that this was very much a matter for Gordon himself and for Gordon in his discussions, which were largely one-to-one with Nick Clegg, because if they were going to forge a coalition government between them, they had to decide how it was going to be led. And Gordon had led us through the election. And remember, Gordon had led us to a much better election result than most people had expected, including most people at the top of the party. So we didn't see it as our job to tell him how he should conduct himself.
Was that a mistake, looking back? Do you think you'd have had if he'd gone on the Friday morning, you'd have, or signalled he was going first thing on the Friday morning?
Well, if one thing I'm sure, as I look back on it, the only way that Gordon could have gone on the Friday is if he'd wanted to go. You know, the day after the election, when you've got a much better result than people expect, and you've been fighting under a leader, literally in sort of hand-to-hand combat, as you are in a general election, through a month, the idea that the senior people in the party turn up and say, and now, Gordon, you've got to go out and tell the cameras that you're going. I mean, that's not the real world. That's not how human relationships work. So if he was going to announce his departure on the Friday, it had to be because that's what he wanted to do. Now, to the question, would that have made a difference? It's hard to tell. My own view is that it wasn't the leadership of a coalition that was the issue between Clegg and Gordon Brown. It was the fact that Clegg wanted to go right rather than left. And he wanted to go right, I think, partly because he felt perfectly comfortable with the Tory economic policy, actually felt perfectly comfortable with the leading Conservatives. It was quite clear that he and David Cameron got on like a house on fire. But also because he'd reached the judgment, which was his to reach, since he held the balance between the two major parties, that it wasn't going to work with Labour. Now, I think there were a whole lot of reasons why he felt it wasn't going to work with Labour. I think that it had something to do with leadership, something to do with the numbers in the House of Commons, common, something to do with the fact Labour had been in for so long, but also I think it had something to do with the fact that, which has become increasingly clear to me since 2010, that Nick Clegg is essentially a figure of the right, not the left. He's entirely comfortable with the Osborne plan and the Conservative economic strategy, and insofar as he's tried to inject a Lib Dem component into the coalition, and it has to be said, not very successfully, it's been on constitutional reform. It hasn't been on this central left-right issue of the management of the economy and how fast you pace cuts, and in particular where the cuts fall, which is why he's been perfectly comfortable with very big welfare cuts. If you think about what the alternative Lib Dem leadership could have been in 2010, where there had been, you know, somebody like Charles Kennedy or Min Campbell or Paddy Ashdown, I find it almost inconceivable that they would have been able to agree with the Conservatives on the central economic plan. And if they hadn't been able to agree on the economic plan, then I think a very different conversation with the Labour Party would have ensued.
Do you think maybe when you look back, you were a bit naive in your view of Nick Clegg? You know, he was, as you say, someone who'd worked for a Conservative in Europe. He was someone who was given to saying things about the social democratic experiment having failed. I was just looking up ahead of this, something I wrote in February 2010. Even the pieces he wrote, the themes he picked out that sounded progressive enough and were progressive enough, maybe, like the pupil premium, it seemed odd that those were the same things, same language that people like Michael Gove were using. Whether the signs were there for Labour people if they'd chosen to see them?
I think the signs were there. The most revealing declaration he made was his doctrine that he would negotiate first with the party that came first in terms of votes and seats. He said that before the election, and then he repeated it during the election. And at the time, that seemed to me to be a clear opening to the Conservatives. There was no constitutional doctrine that says he should negotiate first with the largest party. The position of his party in the past had been one of equidistance between the two major parties, which would have implied negotiating with them both on an equal basis in a hung parliament. Why did he say that? It's now clear to me in retrospect, since it was obvious that the Conservatives were going to be the largest party in terms of
votes and seats.
Well, votes certainly and almost certainly seats. It's clear to me in retrospect that this was in order to legitimise an opening to the Conservatives, and in particular to legitimise it to his own party, which of course is more centre-left than centre-right. Now, we should have been more alive to that. When he made that announcement before the election, I thought he'd misspoken. I thought he didn't understand that there was absolutely no constitutional or historical or, if you look at it internationally, comparative reason why he should negotiate first with the largest party. He should negotiate first, in my judgment, on the basis of domestic and international experience, with the party with which he feels most comfortable. It's sensible to negotiate with both parties if you're in a position to put either of them in, but there's certainly no rule as to which order you should negotiate with them in. And at the time, as I say, I thought he'd misspoken, but it's very clear to me in retrospect that he hadn't misspoken. He's an intelligent guy, Nick. He knew what he was doing, and what he was doing essentially was this process of conditioning his party for going in with the Conservatives, which, of course, he then carried to fruition in the 5 days.
And so if he'd... I mean, he did engage Labour at a certain point. He did, was on the phone to Gordon Brown just before Gordon Brown resigned, saying, please, please, stick around for a bit more. But you think all of that really was negotiation tactics?
Oh, it's very clear that at the end, he was only asking Gordon to stick around, so he had more time to do his deal with David Cameron.
Yeah.
What's particularly poignant in retrospect is that the big argument he uses for Nick, that Nick uses with Gordon to stay at the end, is he wants more time to negotiate on Europe, because Gordon has seriously concerned him in their conversations about the prospect of the Tories seeking to renegotiate the relationship with Europe. And what Nick wants to do is to nail down with David Cameron that there will be no renegotiation on Europe. And this is explicitly stated. Nick explicitly states this in his last conversations with Gordon when he asks him to stay, because he needs, you know, he says, I've taken to heart what you said about Europe and renegotiation, and I need to nail this down.
So it's all Gordon Brown's fault the Tories have gone mad on Europe?
I don't actually, as it happens, think that another day, if Gordon hadn't gone on the Tuesday but had stayed until the Wednesday, I don't think it would have made any difference, because by then, of course, Nick's negotiating position was very weak because everybody knew he was going to go in with the Conservatives. But it is very poignant in retrospect that precisely what Gordon said would happen, which is that the Conservatives, once they're in, would inevitably reopen all of the European issue, is precisely what's happened.
What would you say to those people who, on the, well, I don't know if to call it the right or the market-minded side of the Liberal Democrats, who'd say that someone like you has a you know, coming up through the SDP and having a sort of preconceived idea of what the Liberal Democrats or before them the Liberals should be like, and it's not necessarily what they think they should be like. I mean, aren't they entitled to decide that they quite like conservative economic policy? And
I think that's perfectly fair comment, that there is a generation of Lib Dems who don't use the term social democrat to describe themselves, as my generation did. I mean, some of us actually were in, as you say, in the SDP, but then probably a majority of us in the Lib Dems described ourselves as social democrats. Remember the full
title.
So
you were in the Lib Dems, sorry, just for the listeners who don't know, into the mid-90s?
Until 95, yeah, because, of course, the Lib Dems were the successor party to the SDP, and I continued in it. Now, the majority of us in the early 90s, when asked what our political philosophy was, would have replied, and did reply, social democrat. Remember, the long title of the Lib Dem party is the Social and Liberal Democrats. That is how the two parties, the SDP and the Liberals, were put together with that title. Now, the Clegg generation and people who think like him, David Laws and others, don't describe themselves as social democrats. Mm. They describe themselves as liberals, much more in the 19th century John Stuart Mill tradition of liberalism, which is essentially centre-right, free market, very sceptical of the state, wants a smaller state, not a stronger state. Now, that's a perfectly respectable liberal position. I don't in any way criticise it. I mean, the Dutch liberals, which, of course, Clegg is particularly familiar with, come with that tradition very strongly in their veins. But it's not the tradition of social democracy that I grew up in. But it's a perfectly honourable tradition. And it was the fact that there are Lib Dems, particularly the younger generation of MPs and activists, who came to feel themselves to be liberals, not social democrats, and in many ways, to my astonishment, to define themselves against Labour in the way that David Laws did and does in his book, which he wrote, actually describing the Labour government as in many ways having been a disaster, far too collectivist, far too many failed social democratic experiments, which I find astonishing in retrospect. But the fact that there were Lib Dems who felt like that, and that Clegg was the foremost amongst them, is what made it possible for them to go into coalition with the Conservatives.
One intriguing thing you publish in your book, as well as the kind of pacey memoir, is this David Laws memo, isn't there, about what they were asking of Labour in the such negotiations as you had with them. And there are a few things in there that aren't maybe comfortable reading for the Liberal Democrats now as they battle, for example, on climate change. It was a much stiffer target on green energy. They said that they wanted a referendum, not on AV, which they eventually got and lost, but on the alternative vote. Intriguingly, they wanted a shorter fixed-term parliament. I wonder.
They wanted no increase in tuition fees as well.
No increase in tuition fees,
which we were, I should say, prepared to negotiate with them seriously. That would have been quite an interesting negotiation if that had continued through to the end. But it does sort of slightly beggar belief how they could have been seeking to negotiate no increase in tuition fees with us, and then to have agreed a trebling of tuition fees with the Conservatives. So I can see why it is that that document causes them some difficulties.
We did ask David Laws if he wanted to respond to some of this, but I think he feels he's already said his piece insofar as he's going to, having written a book called 22 Days in May not long before. From the sort of high philosophy, if you like, to the low personalities and so on, there are some real passages in the book where it sounds like, and you're too polite a person, Andrew, I think, to really hammer home the point, but you must have been desperately frustrated with some of your colleagues. For example, when you've got Ed Balls arguing about contact point or boasting about having read Albert Alesina's latest academic paper. And these are not, there might be intelligent points he was making, but they weren't emotionally intelligent points towards making a deal, were they?
Well, Ed was engaging with Chris Huhne and Andrew Stannan in particular, who
Chris Huhne sounds like he was being exactly the same.
What's the best way of putting it? Extremely direct and forthright in the negotiating style. So I think it's quite... This myth was created by the Lib Dems afterwards as part of the explanation to their own party, particularly the left of their own party, as to why they went in with the Conservatives, that the body language was bad with Labour. That's not in fact true. What actually happened in those negotiations was perfectly open and frank negotiations. The reason why, I mean, you mentioned contact point, the reason why we got into a big discussion about it is the Lib Dems chose in particular at the beginning of our main negotiating session to highlight it. I mean, I was, and I think Ed was sitting there staggered that they could regard contact point and other elements in their in there, I think they called it the Freedom Bill, as massive first order issues for the negotiation of a coalition. What we regarded as the big first order issue for the negotiation of a coalition was economic policy.
Yeah.
But we never got into a proper discussion of economic policy because, for two reasons. Firstly, Vince Cable wasn't in the room.
Yeah.
And it's true, Alistair Darling wasn't in the room with us either, but that was because Vince Cable wasn't in the room. If Vince had been in the room, Alistair would have been. And because they refused to allow discussions to take place between Vince Cable and Alistair Darling, even though we had arranged for them. But when it was known to Nick Clegg that these discussions had been arranged, they were postponed. Now, of course, it was at that point that I realised that the Lib Dems were going to go in with the Conservatives, because you obviously cannot have a coalition without agreement on economic policy. And the fact that Vince, who was their economic spokesman, wasn't on their negotiating team, and they wouldn't allow discussions to take place with Alistair on that crucial Monday when we were supposedly hammering out the outlines of a coalition agreement. But instead, as you say, Tom, we were instead debating contact point and things like that in the negotiating session because we didn't have the economic principles there. That tells you everything you need to know, really, about where the Lib Dems were going.
But there was something about discussions with Alistair that might have been had and took place in the end after the whole thing had fallen to pieces. And I wonder, even there, isn't there an echo of this Labour Party ground down by 13 years in Whitehall, kind of assuming Whitehall way of thinking and forgetting how to do politics, with Alistair being dreadfully worried about this £10,000 allowance, which the great austerity merchant George Osborne didn't find any problem in conceding. Oh, we'll just put up VAT and pay for it that way. I mean, it did feel like Labour had forgotten how to do politics reading your book, apart from you, actually.
Yeah, I don't actually think that's fair. You've got to remember that we only spent in total about 3 hours with the Lib Dems. They must have spent five or six times that long with the Conservatives. The reason why we didn't work out, for example, how we would pay for the raising of the personal allowance or what we would do with tuition fees, or how we would handle the pupil premium, is that we had very brief discussions on these points and then they were parked. Now, that inevitably happens when you're in a negotiation, but the reason why you negotiate for 15 to 20 hours rather than 3 to 4 hours is precisely so you sort out these issues. Now, why did we only negotiate for 3 to 4 hours? Because the Lib Dems had no interest in negotiating for longer. What was very clear in retrospect is that they only played us in to the negotiations in order to strengthen their negotiating hand with the Conservatives, particularly on this issue of electoral reform, because the one thing that Nick Clegg knew he could not get away with in terms of his troops was failing to deliver a referendum on the alternative vote. And at the beginning, the Conservatives were very reluctant to move on that, because an absolute red line for David Cameron and the Conservative leadership was not changing the electoral system. And it was only when they were able to play us in, making a firm offer of a referendum on electoral reform, which after all had been in our own manifesto, that the Conservatives moved. Now, come back to this point about Nick Clegg. I don't actually think he was behaving dishonourably. I think actually, to those with eyes to see, and I was a bit blinkered myself during this process, it was very clear he was moving decisively towards the Conservatives. Perhaps it was foolish of us even to have opened negotiations with him, given that he wasn't prepared to give any serious undertaking that he was doing so on an equal basis with the Conservatives. So I don't blame him for that. But that's the reason why we couldn't reach agreement, is because there was no desire on the Lib Dem side to reach agreement or to allow enough time even for the outlines of an agreement to become apparent.
And do you think, looking ahead, that this coalition, just because your book's about coalition, it's interesting to take your mind on whether you think it's going to get through to May 2015 now, or whether it's in some way or another going to unravel?
I think it will get through to 2015 because of the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which means that the only people who could precipitate an early election are the Lib Dems by voting against the Conservatives on a motion of confidence. And I don't see the Lib Dems precipitating an early election because they have too much to lose. So I think it will go through to 2015. And I think our planning assumptions in the Labour Party should be that it's going to go the full stretch. I think it'd be a big mistake to be constantly obsessing about short-term politics, because whatever the short-term political issue of the moment is, might lead to an early election, because I don't think that's going to be the case. What we should be doing is playing a longer game, getting our One Nation offer seriously in position for a 2015 election. If the situation were to unravel unexpectedly, then of course, then we'd need to
pull your fingers out.
we need to fight an early election, but then I think that's going to, because it will be unexpected, I think that will surprise the other two parties as much as it surprises us.
And there is a sense, I think, in your book, isn't there, that it would have been better if some of these conversations had been had 2 years ago. I think it's something that Nick Clegg says to Gordon Brown at one point. People have got to know each other before. Looking at the polls, as I do for the Guardian now, it doesn't seem at all unrealistic to think that there might be another hung parliament. But that's not what you want now, is it?
Well, I very much hope Labour wins an overall majority. And it looks to me perfectly credible that Labour, on the basis of the polls, can win an overall majority. What I also argue in the book, though, and this is my another firm conclusion I've reached from the last 3 years, is that if there isn't an overall majority, and the choice is between a minority government or a coalition, our first option should be a coalition government, if it's possible to form one. Because have you seen the play at this house?
Yes.
The wonderful play at the National? Well, the idea that you go back to night by night, grubbing around,
bringing people in stretchers through the lobby,
as your first choice, I don't think is the right thing to do. It may be that you have to govern in a minority. It may be you can even for a period, as I said, I think would have been the case with a Lab Lib minority government, for a period you can govern with reasonable stability as a minority government. But it's very difficult to govern for a long period of time as a minority without having really serious problems with the minority parties. And so therefore, if there's a choice between the two, I think it's right to seek to form a coalition government if you can do that on an acceptable policy prospectus.
When you look at, I don't know, Labour's head overall, obviously, although, you know, not as commandingly as some people would like, but behind on the economy, behind on the leadership question, on some of the polls at least. And, of course, there's sometimes a tendency for governments to rally a little bit towards the end. I mean, it's all new rules now, maybe, with a coalition. But it does look like there's at least a good chance that there could be a hung parliament. In which case, you're saying you think a coalition would be the right thing to do. Do you get the sense that Labour's now seriously got enough people talking to Liberal Democrats about that eventuality, or are we repeating the mistakes of 2008, 2009, 2010, when those preparations weren't made by Labour?
Well, actually, I think the personal relations aren't bad, they're more than good enough to start opening serious discussions if you needed to after an election, even between Ed Miliband and Nick Clegg, who during the whole of the phone hacking scandal and the Leveson, well, it was a kind of crisis we had last year on Leveson, wasn't it? We're talking a good deal. So clearly, Ed and our expectation is that we'll win a majority, and that's what we should work towards. But I think the personal chemistry is there if needed. One of the surprising things to me in the 5 days is that Gordon Brown and Nick Clegg had never really had much of a relationship before the election. They'd barely spoken, and that was clearly a handicap to conducting serious conversations. But I do think that the personal relations are there. But equally, I don't think you need to do too much on that score. You just have to have channels open. The serious work that you need to do before is when it's clear what your respective policy prospectuses are. That's the work you need to do seriously before, is to work out what the outlines of a policy agreement might be. And that's precisely the sort of thing which serious policy analysts on the two sides need to be doing.
Should each side send a party official to the other's conference to take a note of?
Oh, well, I don't think you need to. You just need to be able to read the words on the page,
right,
when they start publishing their publishing their policies and publishing their manifestos and so on. That work can be done. Now, we had not done that work seriously before the last election, and that was a definite handicap when it came to conducting negotiations.
And I'm interested that you say that now the Miliband-Clegg relationship is sufficiently warm that they, if it came to it, be able to do business. But I wonder, in the same way that Nick Clegg obviously thought in 2010 that there was an issue about Gordon Brown had to go because people weren't too keen on the old regime, whether in 2015 Liberal Democrats hold on to a respectable number of seats, maybe, but obviously will take a bit of a battering, one imagines, in terms of votes. Won't maybe the country as a whole, but certainly the Labour Party, say, OK, we've got to do something with the Lib Dems, that's fine, but not with the leadership of Nick Clegg?
Well, there are two phases to this. Let's be clear. We will be going flat out for an overall majority, and we will be fighting as hard against the Lib Dems as against the Conservatives. And Labour activists, myself included, will not forget what we regard as the betrayal of the Lib Dems over the last 3 years. They basically threw up their own manifesto at the last election, which was supposedly with us on economic policy and went firmly to the right and have gone firmly to the right on many other things too. So I suspect it's going to be a very vigorous general election, and it'll be very vigorous with Labour fighting very strongly against both the Lib Dems and the Conservatives. Then the people make their judgments. And let's hope that we get an overall majority. The scenario we've been discussing is if there isn't one. Now, what's happened in the past, and I just don't think we've been grown up enough about this, is we've all tried to pretend before that it never happens. I mean, I couldn't conceivably, 2 years before the last election, have had the kind of discussion I've just had with you, Tom. Mm. It would have been completely off limits for any senior figure of any of the three parties to, you know, I mean, we've been spending 10, 15 minutes talking about eventualities in a hung parliament. It would have been completely off limits because it would have sounded defeatist. What I think people are now grown up enough to do, because we've actually had the experience of a hung parliament, is it is perfectly compatible to say you're going flat out for majority, you actually think you can gain one, which is a credible expectation in the case of Labour because we're 10 points ahead in the polls, you think you're going to have a manifesto that is worthy of winning a majority. However, if you don't, we are going to talk in a grown-up and serious way to the Lib Dems. I think it's perfectly possible to say both of those things, which is, as I say, my big conclusion from the book. One Nation Labour, more than capable of winning a majority. On the basis of the polls, I would expect us to do so. But if there isn't a Labour majority, then rather than seeking to stagger along in a minority, it is better to try and form a coalition if that's to be had.
Great. Well, thanks very much indeed, Andrew Adonis. We'll leave that there now. His book, 5 Days in May, is out now. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.